Blog Talk Radio.
Hola, this is Jane Hoffman. It's Wednesday going into Thursday. Listen to my homie. They don't want me around. So are you on land or foot?
I am
John
on
Yoder.
Land. I'm actually on land. I'm in the workout weight room over in Marina Del Rey. And I'm kind of kicking back and checking things out.
With Barbell and Brittany?
Yeah, no Brittany, but yes, Barbarella is in the house.
Okay, I was having trouble with my land phone calling in. I called in about 1 minute late. So that was Bob Dylan from Slow Train Coming album, I Believe in You. Anyways, perhaps I'll have the Melbourne Mass Choir sing it next time from Australia. It's on YouTube.
What happened to David Archuleta?
Yeah, we're going to do him tonight.
Oh, yeah.
So basically, you know, he made like one or two pop songs. Now, my question is if you win American Idol, you're under contract, but he got second. He only made one pop song, and then he went in a two-year ministry overseas with the Mormons. And he pretty much faded out. And now I don't think he's back yet, and he's not making pop music. So I'm wondering why he even went to the trouble to do American Idol.
Well, I think, like any person in that situation, what happens is you try to make the most of your situation. You know, if you believe in God, you're trying to be accountable for your gift. And I think what happens is a person like him isn't motivated by the money or by the fame. So when opportunity to minister or to travel or to do something that maybe is a little more humble, like working with poor people or doing something for free, it's almost a greater challenge or allure, because you really, if you believe in God, you believe you're sacrificing, that you have a greater reward. So I could see where, as an example, a lot of doors would open up and people would go, oh, well, you want to do this or that? And some things will be financially attractive. And it's kind of an example for everyone in his circle to see him, to go, you know, he didn't sell out. He's like doing some, you know, free missionary work here, and instead of cashing in and chasing women and partying. So I could see
he's only 25 years old, too.
Yeah.
In fact, he's 24. He'll be 25 in about 5 months.
Well,
the question, this is a broader scope. I didn't just want to do a short little episode on him. The broader scope thing, well, he did perform with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir in 2009-11, Christmas from the Heart. And then he did an Asian tour with them. And he also, you know, he made different appearances. It wasn't necessarily in the mass media, but it was in radio stations and smaller television channels. But his mother is actually Spanish, by the way. You know, the Mormons, they're all over the world. They're not just one nationality. His father is Spanish, Basque, Danish, Irish, and German, and his mother is from Honduras. And His father is also Iroquois descent, which is Native, and his father speaks fluent Spanish. So I'm trying to see what he's been doing the last 2 or 3 years. I know he went down by Indonesia for a while. So broader scope question is, well, he did do an Asian tour called My Kind of Christmas Tour, and that was from 2009 to 2011. The broader question is really what you just hit upon. He's still doing missionary work in the Philippines, and he took a social media break. In early 2012, Archuleta signed a contract with TV5 to shoot a primetime miniseries in the Philippines titled Nandito Ako, Here I Am, which was broadcast in 2012. An original Filipino music album was released in 2012 titled Forevermore. Well, maybe he's just not into America these days.
Well, another thing to consider, think about kids 30 years ago that were teen heartthrobs, you know, Leif Garrett, David Cassidy,
Sean Cassidy.
There's a whole bunch of and, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole line of people. Andy Gibb, people who have the world in their, you know, they have the world by the anything you want to call it. And they lost it all, or they bottomed out, because they chased their fame. They had a lot of access to drugs and alcohol and chemical substances, women, all the power you could want to have at that age, and they just blew up on him. So I see a person like David who maybe isn't maximizing his fame or his financial potential, and I sit there and go, is he happy with himself? Is he a calm person? Is he content? Does he have to be in the limelight, or can he?
No, he doesn't.
I think he's found inner joy and inner peace in his faith and in the values that his church promotes. So I think he's found a good thing, and more so than people. I mean, I was dealing with someone tonight that's yelling and screaming about, they want to meet this agent and that promoter, and things aren't working right, and they're just
all
upset. Your
boss is talking about it?
Well, I couldn't name names, but I guess the point is that, you know, happiness is within you, and contentment. And however you find it, I think it's a good thing. Now, here's the million-dollar question. Michael Jackson was a Jehovah Witness, raised in his family. That's what his family taught him. And of course we mentioned with David.
He also used to go door to door with his mother as a teenager.
Right. So here's the question. Do you think that people that are sincere in those different faiths, that they're going to heaven, God loves them and forgives them, and
I can answer that. I can answer that beyond my narrow-minded twin sister. Because I'll tell you why. In the last 3 years, I've been exposed in different ways to the Mormon Church. The first time I was exposed about 15, whenever you and I met, and that was in 2001, 14 years ago, it was with Matt S. at a certain company. Then I started, there was a campaign to make gay marriage in California legal, and the Mormons turned the tide, and it failed about 10 years ago. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but it was around 2005. The Mormons had a strong factor in that I found out there were thousands of Mormons living in the Santa Clarita Valley. There was a stronghold there, so I started looking into the Mormon faith. And then I recently, 2 days ago on Netflix, I watched a Mormon movie about people from all over the world who were Mormons, like in Utah, Costa Rica, Florida. They showed a guy in Annapolis, Maryland, who was a football coach of the Navy who was Mormon. What the whole premise of the movie was just to be like, they're normal Christians like us. But my main thing is that Mormons are normal in a sense, except for the Joseph P. Smith visions that he had in the woods that they added to the Bible. Now, David Archuleta is making a documentary called to Serve. And, you know, he was only 16 when Idol happened. That was in 2008. He was born in 1990. I think he turned 17 around that time, you know. And then he made only one secular video called Crush. And then he was in a couple Disney TV cameo roles in iCarly and Hannah Montana. Then he was in, like, just a couple live interviews. But then he definitely went straight into the ministry in 2010. And then he didn't get on that Filipino series till 2012. So you're right. He already had a strong, solid faith before he even jumped into that American Idol thing. But the fact that he was so young, he probably didn't want to jump in too fast. But he could have easily been corrupted by those popular other artists at the time, which would have been possibly Miley Cyrus or those two people who did High School Musical, Zac Efron and Vanessa Hudgens. Except for, I don't think Zac Efron is really corrupt, but Vanessa Hudgens took a few dark turns. But basically, the reason I'm doing this show on him is I think he deserves attention. You know, he hasn't picked mainstream choices in his media blitz. And he hasn't even tried to become more popular. He stands on his own with his Christmas album, which was done in the U.S., and other things. And like you said, it's all about the scope of the ministry and your perspective of God.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned that he's, what, 25 right now. And I was actually talking to a friend yesterday, going over a little bit of Jim Morrison. And to think Jim Morrison only lived to be 27, and I thought he at least made it to 30, right? But 27 is nothing. I mean, when you think about how long people live, I mean, you're barely out of the gate. Now, he lived a lot of life in his 27 years and experimented with a lot of things, but the point is he wasn't secure. He believed in a lot of things that were delusional. He thought he was the Lizard King. He thought he was God, which was the god of pleasure, party, and wine, and also known as Bacchus. And
like
so,
Dionysus from the Greek, like Dionysus, yeah. The goddess of wine in Greek mythology.
Right. So he thought he was that. And I was telling this person who was a Morrison fan, I said, you know, you think about it, you start believing this, and then you show up at a concert and thousands of people, you tell them to take their clothes off, and they start taking their clothes off, and you tell them to, you know, let's party tonight, let's just have an orgy, and they start following you. And pretty soon you start thinking, you know, after probably being high on, was it heroin or whatever he was getting into, he's like, I am Dionysus. I am the god of this and that reincarnate. I'm the Lizard King. And
well, he did piss off the band members, you know, because later on when he started screwing up, they always had to cater to him.
Well, what's interesting, I knew someone that was his, the sister of the gal married to, I think it's Robbie Krieger. There's a keyboard player, and I think the guitarist is Krieger. And we were talking, and this gal, her sister was Krieger's wife. She was into Wicca, so she was into kind of white magic, witchcraft, and that kind of stuff. And so we talked about different things, about drugs and sex and God and all these different subjects. And she had mentioned that I told her that you can't do drugs and stay healthy at a heavy level. And she said, well, it depends on what kind of drugs you get. If you get the real good stuff, if you get expensive stuff, you know, it doesn't have the same effect as cheap drugs. I said, yeah, I said, but here's the difference. I said, even if you're using the best drugs, I said, you're not healthy. Like, go out in a basketball court and play for half an hour running up and down the court. I don't care what kind of heroin or what what kind of cocaine or what kind of, you know, product you're using, you're going to suffer physically. She said, yeah, I guess you got a point there. But the point I was making is it's delusional thinking. Yeah, I'm taking the best drugs here, and I'll be fine. It's
well,
like,
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, finish.
I said you're damaging your heart, your brain. You're dumbing it up. You're making it dull. And the only time I want to dull my brain is if they're going to cut me open to, you know, operate, or if they're going to drill holes in my teeth. But the rest of my time, I want my brain sharp. I don't want to dumb it up. And but because you end up being delusional.
I was
going to
mention that the reason why, you know, well, first of all, I may make this reference. Robbie Krieger was born in 1946, and he was a guitarist and songwriter. He co-wrote Light My Fire and Love Me Two Times and several of the other popular songs. But I was going to mention the reason why you think, just from a glancing perspective, Jim Morrison's life seems brief at 27, but he started reading existentialists it's not Freud, but the other one. I can't think of his name right now. And he started reading 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th century philosophers in middle school. I watched a documentary his sister wrote about it. And the most famous existentialist in the world, who I can't think of right now. And he also went to film school, and I have one of his books here, of all his thoughts in film school. And he was a genius long before he became a singer, and he was an intellectual before he became a performer. So the fact of the matter is he was an old soul, and he also rejected his father's military background because his father had pushed him too far into conformity. So that was his major source of rebellion, was his father. I think it was Soren Kierkegaard is one of the most famous, but he had also writings by Albert Camus and some other people.
Nietzsche, right. And that's kind
Nietzsche,
of the problem.
Nietzsche, not Friedrich. Friedrich Nietzsche,
right.
It was.
Yeah, Nietzsche was very, you know, a lot of people got into his stuff, which is very deep, heavy, and somewhat dark ideology, but the problem people have when they get into this kind of stuff and into being very intellectual is it leads you usually to madness. I mean, really, when you think about it, because life is really simple. When you overcomplicate it, when you try to really break it down, you're going to die. And people do bad things. And there's evil, and you can't stop it. And we're all in need of God. We're in need of have faith. And if you don't have faith, people say it's the opium of the religious, and it's just something to keep the masses in order, keep them in line. But the bottom line is, if you don't have faith, you're a dark soul and you're dying, and there's no reason to continue. And you start to resort to things that are even darker, and darker behavior, and you begin to medicate. And you can, most of these people that are into this kind of stuff, they're not like a very happy soul. You know, the happiness of and joy of a child that's innocent and has faith is a beautiful, wonderful thing.
Well, and, you know what? I recently got a free copy of a hardcover edition of Albert Camus' The Stranger. And the whole premise of the novel is supposed to be how he doesn't really react to things in life. Like, his mother's deaf, he kind of benignly explains it, and then later on he accidentally kills someone in some type of skirmish by the beach. But even he said later in his life that, "I am not an existentialist. Sartre and I are always surprised to see our names linked. We have even thought of publishing a short statement in which the undersigned declare that they have nothing in common with each other." So, I mean, what happens was there's always a movement, just like in poetry. There were three or four major movements, and people just get linked to these ideas and concepts. Now, with Jim Morrison, he escaped to Paris to get rid of the media. So from an earnest perspective, he was trying to duck the spotlight. But on the other hand, he hadn't corrected his problem of overconsumption of drugs and drinking. And basically, it was not heroin. I think he basically, his body had broken down at least 2 years before, and he was already at death's door. So, like you said, it was either mind through matter or mind over matter or mind with matter, but eventually the dark choices he made caught up with him.
Right, because especially if you're getting plastered, you're getting drunk, and you combine any kind of
barbiturates,
drug,
yeah.
Medication. You know, you start taking sleeping pills, you start taking uppers, downers, any amphetamine kind of thing, and you start mixing it with alcohol, which is a depressant. You're just, you know, you're punching your heart, you know, right smack in the nose, and it's just a matter of time before you pass out. You choke on your own vomit. You fall asleep in a tub and drown. You know, things like that. And I mean, we discussed, you know, whether it's Whitney or Michael or whoever, your body can only take so much. So that's my stay away from chemical stuff. It's in the rock world, it doesn't have a good track record. And someone like David Archuleta, you're not going to find out him driving 120 miles an hour and hitting a tree. You're not going to find him drunk and passed out, choking to death on his vomit. You know, stuff like that. So I think he's actually
like
very
a Lindsay
role model.
Lohan type.
You know,
like a Lindsay Lohan type.
You know, like Lindsay had everything going for her, and I'm sure at some point you're going to find out when she can't do any more movies and when she's too burned out and looks too haggard. You're going to find that she's homeless and, you know, just doing stupid infomercials or some kind of crazy product scam to try and, you know, pay her bills so she's not homeless. I could be wrong, but I think that's the way it's going to end up.
I agree. And, well, hopefully she won't be homeless. Hopefully she socks some money away. But,
yeah.
Amanda Bynes recently had two or three mental episodes. I don't even know if her parents have a directive over her savings and stuff like that, but there have been a few actors and actresses who have gone nuts.
Britney Spears, you know, at least.
Well,
Mariah
Heath
Carey.
Ledger, he died from mixing drugs and alcohol.
Right. And what's the actor that, I want to say, not Mark Anthony Hopkins. You know him. He's in the 50s. He played Capote, and he's been in a lot of things.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And you look at people like in those situations where they just want to stop and they can't. They go to rehab, they go through different programs, and they just cannot stop. And I would just say myself, I have an addictive personality. I'm glad I've never drank. I'm glad I've never done drugs, because maybe I would be an addict. And I could only imagine, you know, the drama of just overdosing and not being able to stop. That's got to be a terribly scary feeling.
I agree, and I just think that even if you have all the right people around you, some people get screwed up on their own. It's hard to understand
right.
Why, but I think about Michelle Williams, who was widowed after with Matilda Ledger after Heath died, and that must have been hard on her. To be just, you know, stuck there without a husband.
Well, something I was going to mention too, that kind of in line a little bit with the subject, is because I'm a Christian and I believe that you need to believe on Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior for your forgiveness of your sins, if you're a sinner, a sinful person, and we all are, you don't go to heaven. Heaven's a perfect place, and that God's prepared a path of forgiveness for us. But now there's kind of this thought that, well, Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses or Catholics even, they don't believe exactly the way, say, a Protestant or evangelical Bible-believing person believes, that they're not going to make it to heaven because, like with Catholics, they're praying to saints, which is kind of idol worship. They're confessing their sins to a priest instead of a God. In the Mormon faith and in the Jehovah's Witness faith, kind of the catch is always you got to be baptized in their church by their people to get saved. And since if you're not a club member, you really aren't baptized, so you're really not getting the full program. I kind of have this thought towards it all on salvation. Because traditional thought is, hey, they're lost and going to hell. I have very good friends that are Mormons, and my thought is if they believe on Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of sins, they're going to heaven. They may not have perfect theology, but who does? I also feel that there's going to be a lot of people.
Did you say Catholics?
I'll say it was Catholic, you know, whether you pray to your priest or whether you pray to some saint. I don't think that's good. I don't think that's biblical. But if they believe that Jesus died on the cross for their sins and they've asked him into their heart, his Lord and Savior, the Bible says you go to heaven. You know, I mean, I think that's just plain and simple. However, I also think there's going to be a lot of people in there that have never done this. Example, I mean, did Adam and Eve, did they believe on Jesus Christ? No, he wasn't around. You know, did Moses, did Joseph, did Noah, when he got into, and you're like, what saved Noah? He had faith in what God told him to do. Get into the ark and you'll be saved. You know, Moses, it's like, take your people, lead them out of Egypt, go to the promised land. Of course, he didn't even make it to the promised land, but he helped lead them to get to that point. It was faith. And so I think with a lot of people, I think you need Jesus. But I think God is a judge, and if they've acted in faith on what they've been given, I think that's the main issue. Now, most people know about Jesus, and if you don't act on that, I think you're lost. But if you've never heard and you act in faith, believing in God by what he's given you, I think that's God's call as far as, you know, where you go and what happens to you. I'm glad I'm not God.
Well, I did hear that in Jewish times before Christ was born and died, that the Jews always lived for the present earth. They never lived for the eternity. And if you even talk to devout Jews nowadays, they never talk much about eternity, which is it's a puzzling concept, considering that God Elohim, which is our God, grounded his promises in the tribes of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then the promise of eternity didn't really surface until Christ was born, lived, and died.
Yeah, you know, Jesus is kind of the one, or at least how the people who wrote down the words of Jesus, you know, because some people say, well, he didn't really say it, just this is what the disciples wanted you to believe. But bottom line is, I don't think you can pick and choose. If you're going to pick, you know, if you're going to believe as a part of doing to others as you haven't done to you, love thy neighbor as thyself, all that stuff, if you're going to believe that Jesus said that, then I think you also have to accept by faith that he also talks about heaven and hell. And he's very literal. He's very exact about this. And he's kind of the Old Testament Jewish prophecies, they talked a little bit about end of the world and destruction, but not, and a judgment, but not so definitively of heaven and hell and God separating the sheep from the goats and judging each man. I mean, it talks about there will be judgment, but Jesus kind of really brings in the hellfire, eternal flame, eternal torment thing. So
Jesus
really,
does, or the book of Revelations?
Both. all of Jesus' examples of the sheep and the goats, the foolish virgins, and just different all his parables talks about Lazarus, the rich man, and Lazarus, and the rich man burning in hell, asking for a drop of water on his tongue, and it's for Abraham, and he's like, on your life on the earth, you had your good things. And Lazarus was suffering, and now Lazarus is comforted in paradise, and you cannot be, comforted. So,
who can? The people who were around him?
The rich man who ended up in hell. And then he said, well, my torment's so bad, at least let me go back and talk to my brothers and warn them about this place. And he said, they have the prophets. And if they don't listen to those, then, they won't listen to you even if you come back from the dead. So, yeah, Jesus is kind of the spoil sport with all this, damnation stuff. Mr. Love. Tough Love.
We were in Bible study yesterday, and somebody said that Jesus wasn't always fuzzy peachy, sometimes he was pretty... Well, there's all those metaphors in the New Testament about the tongue and the sword. And sometimes Jesus said things, like when Nicodemus came down from the tree, the Pharisee, and Jesus was trying to explain how one must be born of the Spirit. And then he kept re-explaining it. And finally, he said to Nicodemus, he said, you're a teacher of the law and you can't figure this out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, once in a while he got impatient with people.
He was very hardcore at times, and that's why I tend to look not just at what he said, but also how he acted and to put into perspective, because he was saying things to shake things up, and so a lot of times people just look at the things he would say that would shake things up, but not look at the big picture. And by that I mean is like turning the other cheek. He didn't always turn the other cheek. He just didn't.
It's funny you mentioned that because I was listening to Bob Dylan before a concert in Ontario, Canada, and he said turning the other cheek doesn't mean rolling over and playing dead.
And there are many times, show me in the scripture, except for when he was crucified and when he went to and he was punished, show me any time before there where people hit him and beat him. They didn't. Every time they went to go beat, he disappeared. He went away. He avoided it. He didn't say, the Pharisees want to, cause some trouble. I think I'll go and hang out there. Like, no, he left and he went to Galilee. He went to the lake. He stayed away. He was smart.
He retreated when he needed to.
Right.
But then there's the vivid account of Jesus in the temple when he simply lost it. He got so angry that, remember, he drove the buyers and sellers out with a whip? And then he became angry with the Pharisees in the synagogue when they opposed him for healing a man with a shriveled hand on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
And then he also got mad with the disciples. Yeah.
He never did they're trying to set us up and you're going to ask me this question? Sure, I'll go ahead and answer it. And he said, no. He said, I'll ask you a question and then I'll answer yours. And so he would always give him this, like, this double-edged question, like where they would be at this dilemma. If we answer this way, the people will revolt against us. If we answer the other way, he's going to show us that we're wrong. So, okay, we back up. We're not going to answer it at all, Jesus. The point is, he didn't play a sucker. They were always trying to get him. They were always trying to set him up. So when you take a look at a lot of the things he said, it's only one aspect of the whole behavior of Christ. It wasn't his total behavior. We take things out of context, out of one situation, and then we try to apply it to every situation we come into. I mean, imagine if you said, okay, you're a parent and you've got a seven-year-old kid, and you're going to just apply all the, you know, if someone asks you for anything or turn the other cheek, what would happen? Your kid would tell you what to do, right? I want some cookies. Give it to me. And shut up. I don't want to listen to you. And the parent would be like, oh, okay, okay. I'll just do what you say. Turn the other cheek. Kid hits you, right? You ever have a kid? You've had a son, right? Have they ever hit you? You know, try to, you know,
a couple times.
Like, right? And so what do? You go, oh, yeah, it's okay. He's like, no, it's not okay. I'm going to swat you one back. End the game, right? Until the kid gets, you know, like big enough. But at that level, at teenage, you know, it's a different game. But I'm talking when they're six or seven and they're trying to be a little punk ass. It's like, you know, you're looking for trouble, you come to the right place.
Here's one I want to read two quotes, okay? It happened, Luke 11, 27, 28. It happened that as he was speaking, a woman in the crowd raised her voice and said, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that fed you." But he replied, "More blessed still are those who hear the word of God and keep it." John 2:3-5, "And they ran out of wine, since the wine provided the feast had all been used, and the mother of Jesus said to him, 'They have no wine.' Jesus said, 'Woman, what do you want from me? My hour has not yet come.' His mother said to the servants, 'Do whatever he tells you.' He tasted the water, and the water turned into wine." See, he was even being pressured before he went way into the ministry.
Yeah, he got sassy with his mom, right? Isn't they go, like, honor your father and mother? He should have said, "Oh, okay, mom, just whatever you say. I'm a good Jewish boy. You know, you're a Jewish mom just kind of nagging on me. That's what you do. You're trying to guilt me," right? That's the common thing. Oh, here comes the guilt. Jewish mom, you know, Catholic mom. And it's like, what does Jesus do? He goes, "Woman, what do I have to do with you?" It's like,
expecting him to be a magician at that point.
Yeah, I mean, he was about ready to break out the "get thee behind me, Satan" routine on her, you know? This is Mother Mary. This is like the, you know, the Virgin Mother, the Holy One, the Anointed.
The maternal mother.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, I'm on a website right now, God's Word to Women. I like this verse, even though this is more about Jesus being frank. In John 20:17, Jesus said, "Do not cling to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to the brothers and tell them, 'I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God.'" That's when somebody tried to touch him before he was halfway between earth and heaven, and he didn't want anyone to touch him. Remember, there were 6 weeks where he spent on earth before he ascended?
Right. It makes you kind of wonder, like, I know he's got to present himself to the Father, but, you see, he's walking on land. Land is dirty. So I guess it's not bacteria or you know, mud. It's people touching him with their sinful nature. Does their essence, like, just flow through them into him? For whatever reason, he wanted that separation. You know, maybe it was just he didn't want to even the physicality of their thoughts. You know, like, oh, I don't want to worry about lust. These women want to just, you know, grape on me, hold on to me. I don't know. I don't know if, you know, because it would seem to me just even having people in the same room that talking about secular ideas and not being totally spiritual in the moment, I think he wouldn't want to hang around with people at all. Why don't you just go up straight up to the Father, get it done with, and come back, you know, when you're all approved? But I guess he was showing at some level there's a differentiation between us and the presence of God, that we take it as casual, like, God's the universe, and we're in the universe, so everything's copacetic. I think one thing he's trying to show us is that in the presence of God, he's flawless, and we're scum. We don't even you know, register without the right.
I think, you know, Jesus had the nuts and bolts management of God on earth. He was his sole representative. He did have 12 disciples that he recruited, but there were many times where they were socially inept and he had to set them straight. So I'm sure a couple of times when he was in the wilderness, he gave God the once-over.
Oh,
and told him, you know, this isn't as easy as I thought it would be. But I'm sure within his own power, wisdom, and strength that he had the capabilities.
Well, it is incredible the dimensions that God has, because it opens up a lot of questions, which kind of goes back into the whole, if you try to over-reason things, it leads to madness. I'll give you an example. It's like, and this was a heavy discussion I had yesterday with a friend, and because they're studying in school dark matter and how the 95% of the universe is held together with dark matter. They don't fully understand it and how it interacts. And they were saying, as a Christian, their theory was that, you know, maybe God is dark matter or has dark matter. And I was saying, well, to a certain degree, if God created all things and there's evil, did God create evil? In the Old Testament, it actually says he created, you know, even the things that are evil or wrong. And then the next question that follows up to that is God a part of his nature evil? And you go, well, he can't be. He's God. He's righteous. He's this
he
and that.
Can't
it's like, yeah.
be evil, but he can conceive of evil because he's the creator of the world.
Well, you know, as our concept, we would say, yeah, he can't be evil. But kind of what I'm, as I'm going along through life, is looking at, you know, God has anger. And God in righteousness can kill. You know, like, even I mean, sometimes I want to kill someone, but really at heart, I really would not want to kill anyone. I probably, if it came
I don't
down
think,
to it,
it's called a homicidal thought, but really, it's a remote feeling. It's just a burst of anger most of the time.
Right. I mean, to objectively, I have a hard enough time. I remember there was a time in my life, not now, but there was a time in my life I didn't even want to pull the cord on the bus for my stop. I just felt like I was interfering with, don't ask me why, but it just felt like I'm just inconveniencing everyone. It was almost like a super shyness. And it's not that I have this problem right now, but I just remember, it's like, why?
You didn't want to pull the cord on the bus to bring attention to yourself?
Yeah, or maybe I'm not worthy for the bus to stop and obligate it, or maybe I'm just waiting for someone else to pull it. You know, whatever. You know how sometimes you could go in line and get served food. You could claim a prize. It's your birthday. They could celebrate it and do this and that. And there's something inside you that goes, I just don't want the attention, or I just don't feel worthy, or I just want to be quietly in a corner, left alone. For whatever reason, but the point is, that's not my nature to go out and, like, I'm going to take what's mine, I'm going to kill, and that person's in my way, I'm going to kill them. I wouldn't, it would be the last thing I'd want to do. God doesn't seem to have a problem telling people, you know, this group of people are wicked, wipe them out. I mean, Old Testament, that's what he does. And people go, oh, yeah, but that was the law, now we're under
God's Jesus. Momentum changed a lot in the New Testament, though.
It temporarily changed, because when Jesus comes back, he's going to have a sword that pierces people as he lands on the earth, and God's going to take all the wicked, right, and judge them. And he's not even just going to beat them up for like
five minutes. We're in the church age right now. We're in the age of grace. But the next period of history is called the Age of Wrath, where God's
right.
not going to show any mercy.
The age of down and dirty. And the point of what I'm saying is God's always had that nature, always. He's just put it on hold with us, but he still can dole out the punishment. So the point is, in God, there is a dark side, a angry, rageful side. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's part of the program. So for me, is it wrong for me to be dark and mad and vengeful? I'm supposed to show good news and grace and love, so I do that. But I'm in a world where, as I'm going home, you know, even tonight, I might be confronted by someone who wants to hurt me or rob me or kill me. You know, it's the odds of that are rare. But going down Lincoln Boulevard in the west side of L.A. at 1 or 2 in the morning on a bicycle, there is that probability I could run into someone that's just robbed, you know, a liquor store. Or someone that's drunk and their behavior is open to the dark side to do some irreparable damage to me. And do I want to just turn the other cheek? No. My first response is
yeah, but you have to realize that even murders, this is my theory, even murders on Earth are, God knows they're going to happen before they happen. So the fact of the matter is that it's not that God wants you to die, but there's going to... I just watched a show tonight about a man who abducted a six-year-old boy in New York back in the time before people had to worry about their kids. And it took 30 years to uncover the mystery. And basically, it was finally uncovered through a series of witnesses and narrowing facts down and talking to this person and that person and then issues that were done with other things. And basically, that person can see, there was a point where the child molester said that his lust overtook him and he couldn't control himself. But the fact of the matter is that basically he was just a terrible person that screwed up and somehow sexual power overtook him. But it could have been prevented if the person chose to get counseling for those types of feelings. I mean, I'm just saying that anytime, there's always a twofold sword. It can always go either way. Somebody, I'm sure, what I'm saying is not all crimes are preventable, but all crimes are usually committed with some degree of passion, whether it's greed,
right,
or anger, or resentment. So if you get run over tonight or accidentally by a bus, that's one thing. But if you get killed by someone outside the grocery store, then that person probably is second-degree manslaughter, and I'm hoping that's not your fate.
Right, but, you know, it kind of as a follow-up to what you just said, the guy committed this heinous act and then said he couldn't control himself. How many people, adults, have molested a child in broad daylight in front of other people, you know, like in front of the parents, in front of the school, in front of, it's really, really rare. They'd have to be like,
I think what you're going towards is to say that people know when they do wrong.
Yes, he had control. He had enough control to only do it when he's alone, with the kid in the, you know, the garage or the back room or, you know, back of the playground behind a tree kind of thing in his van. You don't see him like, oh, I just walked into the class and I couldn't control myself and I had to molest the kid. No, you can control yourself. You do have, we all do. It's very rare unless you're a babbling, mumbling, homeless person who is talking to imaginary people there. Yeah, you know, those people, I give them a pass. But everyone else, it's like, including myself, I had a choice. I just maybe have control issues when I'm by myself and nobody's watching. But in public, I know what I'm doing. I can dummy up in a second, right? If you're doing something stupid, right, and someone walks in the room, you go, oops, sorry, hold on.
Well, you want to hear something? This guy was really, he was a, you know, when you think about a child molester, you wonder what kind of person it is, and it's especially disturbing when there was this one, he chose kids who were like, two kids who were six. I mean, give me a break. They're barely out of kindergarten. But he had joined some hippie movement in Pennsylvania later. This is years after he molested the New York boy. And they were like this hippie drum beating type group, you know, that wore long hair dreads and like flower power and rainbow shirts. And he took two of those kids from the situation and like the drum beating ceremony, and he brought them on this psychedelic bus that was parked nearby and molested two of the kids. And it was just, you know, the group members, even though they were kind of like spacey hippie types, caught on to the situation and had them removed from the group. But just the whole concept, and then later on in the episode, it showed how he was arguing with the DA, and he would only give like half answers. But then, like in the middle of a sentence, when he was allowed to be interviewed by someone from 2020, he would just stop and say, "Well, why don't you ask the DA? Like, why is he coming after me this way?" Like, he started like thinking out loud what the DA's motives were. Like, he had some kind of power struggle with him, instead of just focusing on what his faults were, which was child molestation. But it basically came down to the fact that he confided to his inmates in the prison cell, and they corroborated the story with two people when neither one of them knew they were giving the other guy away, and it came out the exact same testimony, and that's how he got convicted.
Well, I think, too, there's several different kinds of molesters, and I think, you know, there's the kind that stalk kids, you know, that really make targets. They're perpetrators. They're just plain evil. You know, like they're really trying to take advantage of someone that's innocent and naive. And it is about power. It's not about sex. It's about controlling the situation, whether it's a rapist, a murderer, child molester. It's really a power issue. However, I will say that there are those who do such things that it's not always from a totally dark spot. They're the uncle that the kid likes to play with and hug and kiss and play games. And it's almost like an acceptance game thing. And
I think like 25% is family members or some crazy number.
I can only tell you, there's been several times where I've been with families or friends that have kids. Kid gets on my lap, and they're all lovey-dovey. And I mean, like, I'm not asking them to be on my lap. I'm not asking them to jump on me or touch me or kiss me or hold me or squeeze me or whatever. And I'm like, you know, Jane, you need to get off of Johnny's lap. You know, sit down on the couch here.
Did you have to pick the name Jane?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, it wasn't because of you. It was actually, I have a friend who has a little sister whose name is Jane. Her other name, well, I won't even use her other name. The point is, so I'm sorry, that popped into my mind. It really was unintentional. Freudian slip. But the point is, I can't tell you how many times playing with nieces and nephews where they're like, "Oh, let's play this game. Let's go in the backyard. Let's go in the garage." And I'm like, Uncle John doesn't go into the garage. Uncle John does not go into the back your bedroom. Uncle John does not go in the backyard behind a tree. Uncle John plays ball in the front yard in front of the whole family where everyone can see. Because Uncle John has seen too many things happen to people in public, because some kid got pissed off that they didn't get an extra soda or something, and they make up some stupid story. And, you know, you're just, it doesn't matter who's right or wrong, you're screwed. Your reputation is blown. So, you know, I've run into that. Just now, as an innocent person who doesn't even have kids, I can't even imagine if I didn't set boundaries where I might be compared to other people. You know, it's scary.
Yeah. Well, I haven't been in those situations recently. I mean, I used to work in a daycare. Kids were lovey-dovey, but they weren't overly lovey-dovey.
And it depends. And also, too, you're coming as a female, you know, from that perspective. I'm coming from the viewpoint of a male, and I've had kids that, and it's okay to play, it's okay to tickle, it's okay to wrestle. I'm not saying any of that's bad. I'm just saying they get into a line where they don't understand what they're doing, you know, when they're being physically very close, kissing and rubbing and bumping into body parts, and it's like, you know what, this isn't the kind of game I want to play. I'm sorry. I'm wired differently than you are, kid. You know, in 10 years, you're going to know what I'm talking about. For right now, we're going to play a different game. New game here. And I'm just saying, I have restraint, and I'm a Christian, and I have certain boundaries. What about a person who doesn't, or who dabbles, or who takes a drug, and goes, you know, we're just playing around? It's like, okay. Sometimes I've looked back through my life and wondered with kids, with some of the games that they've played, when I was growing up, I was sitting there thinking, you know, I wonder if my next-door neighbor kids, if they were sexually abused, because they played games that were kind of borderline, like with tying each other up and tickling and doing things. Some of it was innocent, but some of it I go, I hope their dad wasn't doing, or their uncle wasn't playing the same games with them. Because I was sitting there as a kid going, this feels kind of, it's kind of an odd situation. I'm not sure about this game that they want to play. And it's the kind of at the time, never even thought about it. And I was married, I never thought about it. And suddenly, like, I'm about 40, 42, and I'm going, you know, I remember 30 years ago, like, when these kids were playing this or that game, it's like, boy, I wonder. You know, I really wonder. I guess I may never know. But I can understand how someone can go when they're 35 or 40 and they're in a therapy room going, my goodness, I was molested by my uncle. But they couldn't figure it out. It's just like, you know, your mind doesn't process it that way until later on. You go, wait a second, what was happening here, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't think I scheduled the show for the adequate amount of time, and we have to do the wrap-up now because it's going to cut off soon. I think let's just say this, okay? We started the show an hour ago. It's probably going to cut off within 30 minutes. But basically, I think on the last segment, I got distracted. I'll just be honest, I got distracted. Now, based on what your last comments were, I think I have never been in a situation where I've thought about child molestation and people doing things like that, but, you know, I've been in daycare for 6 or 7 years in pretty remote protected places like White Bear Lake and Duluth. I've never really come into a situation where I knew a child molester or people behave inappropriately. Except for, you know, where teenagers have sex before marriage at 16, 17, or 18. So I'm not really sure. I understand where you were going with the comments, but it's not something I could definitely relate to.
Right. And it's not something that, well, I don't know. It would be,
It depends on the ages of the kids and stuff, you know?
Yeah,
I have dealt with middle schoolers in classroom settings where they act real stupid. And one time I had a trivia game where I brought up Taylor Swift's name, and that was a big mistake because they all overreacted. Yeah, well, I just think we were playing a trivia game, and I just picked like the first two lines from the song, like guess the song, and they all went ballistic. So when you're around little kids, you just have to be really careful. But then I guess the only example I can think of is one time when I was living in North Hollywood, Lauren was still in the eighth grade, and one of his friends watched porn on my computer when I was out getting pizza. So I just had to tell him to behave and not do that anymore.
Yeah, and I can imagine nowadays with the so much more internet and kids getting cell phones and access to, and not only just them, but their older brothers and sisters. they'll joke about stuff. And they'll, you know, smaller kids want to be like their older brothers and sisters, so they pick up on little words and things, and they may even ask about stuff, and sometimes they'll get an answer, sometimes they'll get the, oh, you know, when you're older routine, or they'll get a dumb answer, but kids are still pretty smart, and I've seen situations where kids can read into relationships. Like, it is interesting. Like, I remember this one kid, I was about 5 or 6, and they were, like, looking at their, their older brother was seeing a girl on the side. And so, and the girlfriend was overhanging out the house. And she asked, you know, is that your girlfriend? He said, oh, no. Then why is she, you know, sitting on your bed next to you? You know, that's your girlfriend, isn't it? And it's like, kid, you're pretty sharp. You know? It's like, you know, as dumb as I thought you were for, you know, a 6 or 7 year old kid. He's like, you're picking up on the whole show. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, well, I had to be, this kid was wild, and he did grow up in the projects and stuff. And he was a nice, very intelligent, creative, dramatic child. Like, he could sing, he could dance, he could act. But he had an 18-year-old brother who was in juvenile hall. One of his mother's friends was gay, and they hung around the house a lot. But I think that guy was a cross-dresser, too. Like, one time we saw him at the public pool for some reason, my son's friend and the extended family. And I don't know, I just think that he has some awkward influences in his life. So it was an uncomfortable situation, in other words.
Right. It happens. It's, you know, too much, too fast, too young. It kind of, and it's hard to ungrow a child once the innocence is lost. And I think that's why we try to keep kids as innocent as possible, because it's like Adam and Eve. It's like Pandora's box. You can't put the little genie back in there once it's out. And really, that's what this whole life experience is about. It's just God's put boundaries and parameters and said, don't cross these boundaries. And we go, but we want to find out why, right? I mean, you raised your son, probably the one of the biggest things was always why. You know, like, don't go here, why? You know, don't pick this up. Don't say this, why? Why not? You know, and it is probably as much of an answer as, like, no, don't do that. No, put that down, no, right? But why is probably one of the biggest questions kids just constantly ask. How come? Because they're curious. Their minds are wired to want to know. And it's that whole Eve syndrome. She's got to find out.
My son's kind of a closed person. He doesn't push me for any answers on, like, growing up. He doesn't like talking about girls or sex, or he doesn't try and go out and party with friends. He doesn't do any. A couple times he's taken the bus to his other friend's house without telling me, and then I kind of have to figure out later where he is. But, I mean, he doesn't do anything that's really risky at all.
Wow, so, I'm impressed.
Well, even in L.A. where he grew up, luckily we got out of there before any real shit went down.
Well, that's a good thing, you know, and hopefully that will stay. Some kids, you know, act out later. Sometimes it's better younger than older. But on the other hand, some people, they don't ever have to bust out and go crazy. I always, though, have this attitude, and it's kind of helped me through life, and that is anyone at any time is capable of anything. The only thing is the odds of it happening. So I believe anything can happen at any time, but the odds are probably not. I'm not paranoid, but I'm not surprised. Like, people will tell me, oh, I'm happily married. I said, I believe you. I said, what's your wife doing right now? Oh, she's at home. She's at home. What is she doing at home? Oh, she's doing stuff. I say, how do you know that? Well, because she tells me. I mean, right. But how?
Well, in Minnesota, you know, like, I hear, I mean, you can't have too much doubt, but in Minnesota, like, a lot of kids don't get wild till their freshman year in college when they're away from home for the first time. You know, they don't take city buses or, you know, do things like that. You know, so where were you going with the infidelity thing? Like saying that some people really don't know their spouses?
We don't know anyone, you know. The person you trust the most, like, they could be, once they get off the, like me, once I get off the phone, I might be going to a rave tonight. I might be banging five chicks on the side. What are the odds? Pretty rare, but it's possible. And we go, wow, but that would never happen. That would, no, all possible. Because
look at Jimmy Swaggart. Jimmy Swaggart messed up.
There's a
and
whole
he
bunch
was
of
really,
things.
I've seen a lot of his ministry shows. He's a pretty square dude. I mean, he really even had no business. He had no business even in that prostitution realm.
Well, you know, I think he's even sincere about his life. And just, what do you do if you have a character flaw and you're in front of millions of people and it starts to get analyzed? What do you do? Do you say, hey, you know, I'm a closet alcoholic? Hey, I'm a closet sex pervert, or whatever. Do you quit? And let's say it's something you struggle with for years. Do you quit everything you do? I mean, how many people? The thing is, we have a double standard. People in the secular world, rock stars, they can do all this stuff, and we go, ah, he's a rock star. But
you know what?
So
Amy Simple McPherson, she disappeared for 3 days and staged her own disappearance, and one source said that she was having an affair with a married man. So she, instead of trying to handle the pressure or just trying to stop sinning and resolve the matter, she just, like, disappeared.
And she's a
human. Did you know that? Did you know that?
Yeah. In fact, my mom went to Life Bible College in the 50s. So it's probably about 10 to 15 years after that. But she, I mean, she saw Amy in, you know, the kind of the, towards the end of the heights of her empire. She did one service, she drove a motorcycle down the center aisle, shook things up. She loved plays, musicals, presentations.
She always spiced up the audience. Our history teacher at Ellie Valley College had us watch a documentary on her life. And she had a lot of positive attributes, and she did a lot of faith healings. She really only had one big screw-up, and that's when she disappeared because she breached the trust of the church members.
Right, but then again, to that degree, doesn't a person have a right to you know, get away? And let's just say once a year, most people go on vacation for a week or two. So she went for 3 days or a weekend or a week, and she just didn't tell people where she was going. You know, it's like, what do all of our pastors do in their time out? You know, what if they ever watch porn? What if they ever have a girlfriend on the side or thought about having a girlfriend? They're human.
I don't like thinking about those kind of things, to tell you the truth.
Right, but here's my point of what I'm getting at is that the reason I'm a Christian isn't because I'm perfect. The reason I'm a Christian is because I'm a flawed human being seeking repentance and seeking to try to become a better person. And if I didn't have Christianity, I would sink to the lowest level. So when I have character flaws, it's not to validate I should be wrong. It's to validate that I need help. And that's why I am a Christian. I think people kind of miss that point.
Well, I know, and I'm not trying to point the finger on any public figure. That's not where we started with this conversation. We basically, I'm just going to reiterate it now because I have to go to bed now. We started with the fact that there was one pure example of Christianity in the music world. It happens to be David Archuleta. There's not a lot of examples you can think of nowadays, where he didn't enter the entertainment business to self-exalt himself. He always had the ministry of God on his mind, and he stuck with that mission from the time he was 16 till now, 9 years later. But we see people along the way who had no intentions to mess up, but they did. One time Jimmy Swaggart went into a domain of a prostitute but never slept with her. He just hung out in her domicile. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation in the news and the media. Even Amy Semple McPherson's situation got exploited by the news because she was such a popular figure at the time. They had to make it a big news splash. So my conclusion tonight.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, but who's to say, kind of going back to my point, what's David Archuleta, and I believe right now at this moment, or if he's awake, he's doing something very innocent, very pure, very charitable, or when he wakes up, he will. But who's to say tonight he's not got, you know, a chick in the back, you know, room that's even a Mormon chick that's, like, obsessed with them, and they've got a thing going, and it's, would he publicize it? Would he make news?
The thing
would he cover
is,
it up?
John, is, I don't want to go into dark, as you were talking before about dark energy and dark universe.
Right.
I don't want to go there because there's some people I uphold to righteous standards. And he's in my Bob Dylan Holy Trinity pool. So I don't want to go there tonight. I don't want to cast doubt on someone who's a man of God. Now, if you want to do that with someone like Justin Bieber who screwed somebody in the bathroom after one of his concerts, go for it. But don't touch my little David Archuleta.
Your inflatable little David Archuleta doll. We're going to leave it totally pristine.
You're damn straight. He's lived a pristine life. He deserves to be exalted in the name of Jesus. Not
we
for
will.
His own sake, but for the, I'm going to put Barbell in straight into your noggin. I'm going to threaten you like I did Don the other night.
Now, here's a question. Have you
can you hold
been
the
baptized?
Floor for, can you hold the floor for 120 seconds? I got to make a quick run somewhere.
Yes.
Okay, well, you go ahead and philosophize. I'll be right back.
Yes, we won't have dead air. I'll fill it. So for those of you who are listening, we can surmise that Jane has the hots for David Archuleta, and we will pray that by no circumstance that David will be caught alone in a room with Jane so that he won't be violated because he is pristine and pure and everything that America embraces, including the flag, red, white, and blue. But I do admire his body of work and the fact that he's had a path of principle, and I haven't followed him. I'm not a disciple, but just the things that I've seen or heard about him seems to be really pretty cool. So thumbs up to David. There's also a couple other people. Chris Daughtry is a Christian. Has very positive music. I have Christian friends who really like Daughtry. And yet he still performs in the secular field. I hope that, you know, Daughtry has been able to keep his marriage and everything intact. You see certain celebrities and performers, and you always hope, it's like, man, I just hope that they stay on the straight and narrow and don't really screw up their life or do something silly. I remember when Mel Gibson came out with The Passion of Christ, my only thought was, like, please, Mel, don't screw up. Don't have any skeletons come out of the closet. And wouldn't you know, within a couple of years, everything hit the fan with Mel. To the point where really all he could do is, like, maybe play a dark character or two and people would believe that he was, like, the bad guy. But, you know, life does go on. And obviously, we're all imperfect people. So when we do
okay,
find
I'm back.
I
my
just,
question
I
is,
just,
John, is when you're bringing up an example as the devil's advocate, are you doing it to cast doubt on the prospective person, or are you just making a philosophical statement that nobody's perfect?
More that. In my life, I've just been to so many times where situations would come about and people would say, there's just no way this or that could happen because so-and-so is the straight arrow. Or I remember one time investing in a deal with a friend, and I said, you know what? They were married. I said, the only thing I don't like is what if this, you know, your partner decides to bail? And they said, that would never, ever happen. It's impossible. I said, well, yeah, but, you know, things can happen. They said, no, no, you don't understand. You just don't understand our relationship. She's so into me, it could never, ever happen. I said, well, happened to me, happens to 50%. There's no one that gets married that says, you know, we're just going to be together for a couple weeks and then it's going to burn out in a couple years and we'll go our separate ways. Everyone believes it's forever and this is our soulmate and I've found, you know, total happiness. And it's just misperception.
I do think you have a root of bitterness, though, because you have to weigh a situation based on how the two people know each other. And it could be a perfect relationship, like they've known each other in the church for 10 years. But the fact of the matter is you're right. Your marriage did fail, but not everybody's will.
Well, yes and no. See, like when you say I'm bitter, actually, I'm neither. I'm just I go by statistics. I'm into numbers. I like baseball and sports. I love statistical probabilities. So when over 50% of marriages end up in divorce and over 50% of those remarriages end up in divorce, I'm not speaking as a negative, angry, bitter person. I'm speaking just as a statistical realist.
I'm not saying you're being negative. I just think that you have a mental block when it comes to trust in marriage.
Maybe so. I could be a monster. I have no problem with that. I find it actually helps me because I run into situations where I have to be like the badass people. And before I would hesitate or flinch. And now I just say, yeah, you know, I'm a bad person. I'm a monster. And it goes like, I'm going to do what I need to do. And it's like it loosens up the pressure. Sometimes I even tell people, I tell them, like, just repeat after me. John Yoder, you're an asshole. Just say it. And they're like, no, I can't say it. No, go ahead, just say it. It's liberating. I'm an asshole. Just say it. Say F me, John Yoder. Just go ahead, do it. And they finally do it, and they start laughing, right? It's like it's silly. It just takes all that pressure, like I'm supposed to be perfect or they're supposed to accept me. It's so constricting because then we start compromising everything to make people happy. It's like, no, I don't have to make you happy. I'm imperfect. I'm trying to
be
the best.
Well, I think most of the time you're an effective devil's advocate, but just like many other people. For example, if you said something to tick me off tonight about Clinton or Reagan or something I used to really care about but find myself not so much caring about anymore. But or you might just
uh-huh.
say something like, Minnesotans are they try to come across innocent by playing the Garrison Keillor Lutherans versus Catholics thing, but really, it's just as corrupt a state as any. Or, I mean, just something to really step on my toes. I might get pissed. But generally, I think I am.
Uh-huh.
I was looking through some of my poems when I wrote between 18 and 25. I was generally pretty idealistic about people, but pretty cynical about institutions like government and business. So
right.
It takes a lot for me to bring down my faith in somebody.
Well, in my situation, it's not just about marriage. I mean, I was a quarter of a million in debt because I was optimistic that the real estate economy would correct itself and the government would turn things around. You know, I invested many years in the music industry trying to make it, believing, having faith that, you know, I could connect because I have this magical thing and people, you know, like what I do and I'm on a mission from God. I've come full circle where I probably won't change the world, and I'm cool with that. I'm not like crazy and upset and mad. I'm going to jump off a bridge. My music inspires me, and I resonate in it, it's given me clarity. If it inspires a couple other people along the way, God bless them. But it doesn't.
You're probably
have to.
Touching as many people now as you you're still touching people. You're still doing the same thing. You're just not earning a living doing it.
Possibly so. So we all just kind of figure out what works and what's effective. For me, it's effective to be a little skeptical. I like it. I've been optimistic all my life, and it hasn't really gotten me to a point. I mean, I'm working two jobs and watching a dog, you know, for my...
You are in a rather humble position of it. I'll give you an example. I write for The Reader, right? A lot of the stories I did were like just columns where it was somehow a reflection of my life. But one time I did a story on a group of disabled people who do go from, you know, nursing homes to different places to perform this thing. And I covered the production. I wrote an article about it. Their performance was called Earthlings from Outer Space. It was about aliens and how we relate to people and how people want to be treated. But the production was so professional with the technical and the lighting that I had to treat it like a regular professional theatrical performance from, you know, an all-star cast in New York. And that's exactly what they deserved. And I got more attention from that article than I did from probably any of the other ones that I had written in a year. And the disabled community was so thankful that I just recognized them.
Wow.
And I don't get paid to do that. I get $20 food certificates once a week, which really don't add up because it's the same place, and now I'm getting damn sick of the food.
But we might
think that we're not effective. Sometimes I look at our blog talk statistics, and some of our best shows hardly get any listens, but some of our worst shows get a lot of listens. So it's just strange how things, you know, things add up in bizarre ways.
Oh, yeah. I think the main thing is that you believe in what you do. You know what you're doing if it's effective to you. And then if it influences other people, that's a nice thing. And if every once in a while you have to cut a corner, maybe compromise a little to go over the top, fine, as long as you know your boundaries. Because the higher up you go, you have to compromise. It's just bottom line. If you want to be national coast to coast, you're going to have to do something like the article on the Kardashians, or your commercial is going to have to be sponsored by, you know, Michelob or the Carl's Jr. chick that's going to walk out in a bikini. I mean, what does that have to do with the burger, right? In fact, if she eats the burger, they should have some 450-pound chick walk out there, or some fat guy with a wife beater T-shirt on, right? If they're eating all those Carl's burgers. But the point is, if they were sponsoring our show, I probably would be saying nothing but nice stuff about it. I probably would take a picture with the bikini model. You know, hey, you know, we're national. So there's always some level of compromise for success. The more you compromise, usually the bigger the success. The less you compromise, you know, you limit yourself. Like Keith Green, he didn't compromise anything. It limited his success. But it was powerful.
I agree. Yeah, look at Keith Green. He reached a major pinnacle and was an extremely effective minister with Last Days Ministries. And then he turned up dead. Boom, his life was over.
And that made me question a few things, because there's a lot of things in life when we go as God's will. Maybe. If you jumped off a bridge, is it God's will? And you say, well, no, God doesn't want you to jump off the bridge. Well, if you get in a plane that's meant for 5 or 6 people, and there's 9 people in there, and it's loaded with supplies, and you would say, well, that's pilot responsibility, actually. It's not Keith's responsibility or any of the people. The pilot, you know, should have said, hey, this isn't a safe situation. But then it goes back the other way. It wasn't like a big commercial flight. It's a small passenger flight. he's, you know, he's just like you and me. You get in there and you go, you know, this is a little too much. We should really unload some things, take some people out. And I'm not even saying that would solve the problem. Maybe it would have crashed anyway. But the point is, I don't know how much responsibility that was of God or of Keith, or if it was just meant to be that way. It's interesting. It's food for thought, because there's a lot of things that happened in my life that I was trusting God to take care of, and God was trusting me to look out for it, you know?
Well, I think that it was something I wanted to mention earlier. Like I said, if you go out tonight and you get run over by a bus versus mugged, where Bob Dylan, in one interview when I discovered last week when I was going to do a show on him, he, three or four times in the same interview, he mentioned destiny. He never doubted that he wasn't going to be a celebrity. He knew he was going to be, even before he got to New York and started playing in the Gaslight Coffee House. He knew that he had the gift and the determination. Now, in your case, maybe you didn't reach as far as you wanted to go, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, we all have a destiny, and even if we make mistakes, God can contour that destiny into something successful. When I first got to Duluth, Minnesota, I felt like it was a huge mistake. The weather was unbearable. I didn't think my son could adjust here. And now everything's turned out perfectly. So I just think that we all, it's okay to doubt, it's natural, it's human, but we all have to keep things in perspective.
It's a walk of faith, which we kind of talked about earlier. You know, it's all about having, you know, not being so skeptical or so analytical that it leads you into craziness. Simple faith, believing God's in control at the end of the line, and that you're happy with where you're at, content, you're doing the best you can. You're not just going to be so satisfied that you don't seek to improve. No, that's not the thing. But you're not driven to the point of being so bitter every day that things aren't coming out perfect. But I think along with the point that you mentioned about Dylan, every artist that goes to L.A., New York, Chicago, or Miami, they believe that it's their destiny to make it. For every one, you know, Bob Dylan's that make it, there was like a million Bob Dylan's that went to a bigger town seeking the bright lights that didn't make it. I think the point is, every person, if they are going to make it, you have to have that kind of faith and determination. But your final outcome or destiny, it's really out of your hands. Because if it was within our hands or power to do, we all would be successful artists, you know, business owners, rock stars.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that when I'm talking about destiny, it is a God intervening thing. Like, not all of us can write lyrics like Bob Dylan or even Madonna. When she got out of the cab in New York, she had $34, I believe. You know, like, not all of us are destined for greatness or rags to riches stories, but that's only an American-driven concept. Sometimes you have to separate yourself from the entertainment industry and just see what your problem right now is. You don't have time. You don't have any problem being a service for